Welcome, travelers. I'm Josh.
I'm Glenn.
And I'm Lee Wanika, and this is Tabletop Journeys, where we will be your not-so-humble guides on the quest for RPG adventures.
Here at Tabletop Journeys, we are all devoted role players and storytellers at heart, and we absolutely love sharing our passion with you. On our show, we feature diverse tabletop RPG systems, demonstrating them through actual plays and breaking down the rules to provide you with tips, tools, and techniques to help you navigate them. We also love bringing the content creators behind these games into the studio to give you a peek behind the curtain with relevant and insightful interviews.
Let us help you get the most out of your story, no matter what game world or system you're playing, because detailed settings, heroic characters, diverse NPCs, and a focus on story over rules can make any campaign legendary. Now, here's a message from friends of the show.
My name is Nick Perrin, and I'm an actor, writer, and game master. And on Tabletop, I talk with an expert game master every week to find out the best ways to run amazing games and tell epic stories. Looking to start DMing? Or maybe you've been a game master for a long time and want to spice up your table? Then this podcast is for you. Tabletop is released on Mondays wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everybody, to Tabletop Journeys. Very excited to be talking about tonight's concept, because this is probably one of the coolest things that I've seen come down the tabletop role-playing game space in quite some time. Very excited to be talking about it with my two beautiful human being co-hosts, Mr. Glenn Myers, Mr. Lee Wanika Miller. Gentlemen, how the hell are you? How are you?
Josh, let me start by just saying you two are a beautiful individual.
I appreciate that.
You know what I'm saying? We are talking about beauty of the soul, and you can take it up with Jenny for anything beyond that. But we have said many times before that we're three faces made for radio.
Yeah.
None of us are exactly winning People Magazine's Sexiest Man Alive or any of that.
No,
stuff,
that's so. True. True enough.
But doing well. It's been a beautiful day. Having a wonderful time down here in North Carolina still. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited to talk about this adventure.
Yeah.
That we got to read. I didn't even know it existed until y'all put up the episode card, but I realized that probably makes sense because it's only been out for a little while now.
I didn't know that it existed until I found it.
Well done.
Yeah, it was an excellent find. And despite the fact that most of the faces on this podcast are built for radio, I'm just going to come out and say it because somebody has to. I don't know about y'all, but I'm drop dead sexy. That's just the fact. But getting into the adventures, we've covered the factual portion of our podcast. Let's get into the fictional and fantasy element of the podcast.
I'm not sure I agree with your categorizations, but that's okay.
Yeah, no.
Didn't you know this was the beginning of the opposite sketches? No, but
is this like one of those logic puzzles where like one of you always tells the truth and one of you always lies and we have to figure out which one's which? Is that
no? So now say yes, Lee Wanika, say yes.
Yes, exactly right. Yes, absolutely yes. Without any hesitation, yes. Yeah, puzzles. We're going to talk about some of those today, I think.
We are going to talk about puzzles today.
Yeah.
Exactly. So if you have
but not
seen-
from Labyrinth.
No, not from Labyrinth, no. So tonight we are talking, like I said, one of the coolest things that I've seen come down the pike in quite a while. NASA, of all people, in fact, specifically, was it Goddard? Which, yeah, put out
Goddard Labs in Maryland, if I remember
correctly. Yeah, put out a role-playing game adventure set in a relatively a fantasy-inspired present, I think is probably the best way that I would go ahead and put it. But it is this wonderful blend of like fantasy role-playing, but science fiction, and just really nifty campaign design called The Lost Universe. And it's fabulous. It's amazing. I really enjoyed reading through it. It's basically system agnostic, but it reeks heavily of Dungeons and Dragons. Let's be honest here. Like, it's, there are no D&D rules in this, and this very easily could port to a Dungeons and Dragons adventure. I think that it could port to pretty much any system with a little bit of lifting, but it would port to Dungeons and Dragons pretty much natively. Maybe there are, maybe saying that there are no Dungeons and Dragons rules in it isn't true, because I know that they use DCs, there's some other kind of like gaming convention type things that are very D&D sounding.
But they still keep it generic when they're talking about DCs.
Really generic,
they don't set them. They say an easy DC or a medium DC so that you can adjust that to whatever system you're playing.
Yeah.
Which is pretty neat. I liked the way they kept it system agnostic.
Totally agree. Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I actually had a note to talk about that in specific. I really liked that. And even as we are constantly writing D&D adventures, I think that works, because we've had situations where we've done some work or some collaborations where the types of players we have at our table, we can set a DC at X, Y, or Z, pick a number. And for the tables we play at, just because of the way they build characters or they manipulate situations, that what some consider medium is easy for the folks we game with, and what some consider hard is medium for the folks we game with. And we found that when we were pitching some ideas at various times, and people were like, that's a killer. That's going to be really tough. And we didn't believe it for a while. We said, they're the publisher, we're the writers, we'll go with their guidance on this, without truly believing it. But I then ran that adventure at a convention with people that I never game with other than my son. So my own little scientific experiment. And what I found is they were right. The things that they said were going to be tough and going to be difficult absolutely were many tables, but not for some of the tables that we happen to be with. Now, that's a factor of the way our folks tend to collaborate, the length of time that our gamers have been gaming together, knowing each other's things. But what I also found is, just on an individual basis, just because of the way in which my son games, because he came up with all of us and the way we play, he found some of those things more to the level that I would find easy or difficult. So there's some merit to set it at a medium difficulty. Now let the GM decide what medium difficulty looks like for their table, even if everybody's playing 5e or medium difficulty. I think I'm going to do that in a 2d20 system. We're going to say three successes might be medium, or maybe it's hard. It depends on if you're playing STA. What if you're playing Conan or Fallout or some other 2d20 system? Don't pick a number, because that number might not be accurate for the specific system, world, level, or table you're playing at. So I loved that convention.
Yeah, totally. And I thought that was one of the things in this. Like, there's a lot to love in this little 43-page packet. And I thought that was one of the things. I thought the way that they handled the system agnosticism or the cross-system ability or whatever kind of term you want to use to go ahead and describe it, I thought the way that they handled that in particular was really good. Yeah. And let's be honest, too, as folks that are like in the late stages of writing system agnostic content for our factions book, writing system agnostic stuff is hard. It is hard to go ahead and escape from tropes that make it sound like one game or another. And that's been one of those things. I'm sure that I did it in my documents. Leunika, I saw a bunch of yours. I know that, like, all of us did it. This is a term directly from D&D 5. Do we want to use it? And that's I thought that the way that they squared that circle was pretty elegant and pretty neat. Yeah. So good stuff.
Indeed. And I really loved the way that they blended actual educational science into a fantasy, I'm going to go ahead and call it D&D game, because they list ancestries like tiefling and drow, etc.
Yeah.
To cover things to include in the appendix where they give you common or layman's terms versions of the energy of a vacuum and the dark matter and dark energy that make it up, and Einstein rings and gravitational lensing. All of those things are actually brought into a fantasy role-playing game.
I
thought that was fantastic.
Yeah. This is a nerd's nerd packet right here. It really is. Like, it is, it scratches so many itches. If you are at all enamored with astronomy, if you like physics, if you like fantasy, if you like malfunctioning space hardware, if you like black holes, if you like exploding suns, if you like high magic campaigns, if you like whatever, this is got it all, which is amazing to go ahead and say. Look, is there a single thing, I'm going to go ahead and throw a little bit of shade here. Is there a single thing that Wizards of the Coast put out last year that is anywhere near as good as this? Anywhere near, like anywhere in the ballpark, anywhere in the universe of this thing. And I don't think there is. This is probably the best D&D module I've read in a really long time that we didn't write.
Not because I'm trying to split hairs, but I'm going to throw a little shade back. And I'm going to say, this is really good, but that's a hard statement to quantify and qualify. Because there are some things this adventure, there are many things this adventure does really well. But there are some things this adventure doesn't quite do as well as it could.
Okay. All right.
I want to jump in at this point, Glenn, and then I'll let you get right back into where you were going with that, because I'm very interested where that is. But I would also say this. The challenge for me is that we're almost comparing apples and oranges when you make that statement, Josh, because Wizards of the Coast doesn't print single adventure modules. They don't make that.
Not anymore.
That's not their 5e model. So – the few times they will have starter adventures, or they will have things that akin to that, but by design, it won't be as well involved as something like this either. So now if you're asking, is this better than any of the things, the millions of things that are on the DM's Guild or that come through various crowdfunders? I say it's on par with some of the best. I don't know if it's better or worse. It really depends on where you're fitting it in, what you're doing. I think there's some very situational elements to that kind of a question, but I will, without any equivocation, say it's one of the top ones. I'll say this in addition, then I'll let Glenn pick up.
Well, because I want to address that point before you let Glenn go. That's okay.
But and that is this. One of the greatest things that I think this adventure did for me as a storyteller, as a game runner who runs conventions, is this was a beautiful template for any game that I want to run. I'm looking for type things that are quick, one session, one shot games for
3-4 hours. Yeah.
For everyday heroes. This would be a brilliant template for a Star Trek Adventures game. I'm thinking Enterprise era. Awesome. As opposed to magic, now it's science that does fantastical things. Bob's your uncle. I think these would be great. Or maybe even set this
in. Uncle Bob.
Or set this in Cohort Cthulhu or something like that. Again, this is an adventure module in that narrative scope. And that's the thing I picked up. Because it was not system specific, they really dug into the adventure notes. And what I really loved is the blurbs about how to play an NPC. Without even seeing stats, I knew more about how to play an NPC than most of the NPCs I see in many other modules.
Exactly.
No, I was very much a fan of that. This is how to play, and then the name of the NPC is a fantastic sidebar.
And how to run the adventure, too. They had the bit about how to run it for storytellers also. Mm-hmm. I want to address one thing that Lee Winnica said, Glenn, and then I promise we will let you talk.
No worries.
I promise you. If this adventure had been the first or second chapter in the Spelljammer book, that book is infinitely better.
So absolutely.
They do short form adventures, and they don't do them well.
Except Spelljammer was not designed to be a short-form adventure. That was designed to be a campaign from 1 to 13 or whatever the actual level was. So it was not designed to be a short adventure. So what I'm saying is it's still apples and oranges. They were two different design purposes. And because of that, I don't think it's a good comparison.
Yeah,
fine. Regardless, this was definitely better.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's a good comparison. All
right. Go ahead, Glenn. You carry on now.
No worries. So the only thing that I would say specifically about that, I'm talking about some things that it could have definitely done better, is when it gets into the adventure itself. The material is fantastic. The background material is fantastic. The scientific material is awesome. I love the way the characters are introduced, and I have a whole bit about that. But once they're actually out of the city and off exploring the ruins of the old capital city of the planet.
Mm-hmm. So you're basically talking about part two.
Correct. Yep. And I realize, although the same could be said for the first city, the first part, but you do have the whole city, and it does talk about if they want to explore, the storyteller can build it up. But when you get to those ruins, there's effectively two intact structures left. That part, the exploration piece, is a two option path that leads to a convergence, and that's it. So you start here at A or start here at B. After you do whatever's going on there, either way, you wind up at C and then straight to the end.
Yep.
In a ruined city, I felt like there's more opportunity there for adventure. There's more opportunity there to have maybe not complicated the plot, but drawn it out, had the missing people and the missing technology in different locations. They did work some puzzles in there too, which is cool, but that was very simple and streamlined. And I know it's to try to create a time-boxed session, but to me, it felt too streamlined.
Yeah, I do agree with you there. I think that the layout that they did for part one and part two, where part one had the capital city and you could go ahead and explore all these things, and then part two where it's you're in the ruins, like the deep, dark secret ruins with all the mystery, and there's really two options. I think they had those reversed. I think I would have rather fewer options in the capital city, maybe like a patron or a quest giver who's saying, hey, I need you to go do this thing, right? And then they go to the ruins, and then there are all these options in the ruins for them to explore. And then that can go ahead and change how the story ends. I think that it would be one thing that I would be like, I'm with you on that. I think that they had those backwards.
And both of those paths that lead to convergence point C, both just appear at convergence point C, which is a large metal door, without any discussion, because both of them are like, you continue down the stairs, or you continue down the hallway, and you come to the large metal door, you shift to the convergence part, without ever passing the hallway that would have led to the other place?
So I think I have a response for why that kind of works like that. Because they didn't have a specific grid map like you would see in a VTT or roll out on a table, they don't need to. What they're basically saying is you could say as a GM, the thing you're looking at is
through a zillion other things.
Yeah, is on the west side. You go through whatever. You pass through an old kitchen, different things. Describe whatever you want to describe on your path. If they had gone any other way, it's a whole different description. You can do whatever you want to get from these various spots to other spots. But the idea is at the end of that section, you're going to end up at the same door. There's a term for that in it, when you're playing theater of the mind, and I can't think of what it is. It doesn't matter if you go left or right. It doesn't matter if it's the room on the left, the room on the right, the stairs up top, or the hole in the ground. The next room is always going to be the next room, and that's the secret sauce that players don't usually see.
Right.
As storytellers reading an adventure, we can see that. So part of the thing that you got to think about is, if I'm at the table running this, do my players realize that it's just that boxed in?
Sure.
My guess is they probably won't. I doubt they would if it was one of the three of us or some other more seasoned GMs and storytellers running this. However, the way to make sure that even a novice storyteller doesn't end up with that negative or less than positive feel would be to have other options when you're in the city. So you're right. We know where they need to go. They did a good job of saying whether you go to the tavern owner or the cops, that's how you get the adventure. What they could also do is, what if the people just decide I want to go shopping? What if the people say, look, we better find ourselves a place to hide? A beggar on the street needs to do something. I think and part of it may have had to do with the page count thing. We won't know what ended up on the floor. But if I was a storyteller, I know because of the players that I typically have, they're going to either avoid the cops or run straight to them. But if they're likely to avoid the cops, they're also likely to avoid the most common place to go, which would be the tavern. They're probably going to do something totally unprepared for. Somebody's going to want to go see, if they know the magic they had, that means one of them's a priest. One of them's going to go see a priest. One of them might just go directly to the center of learning because, hey, I know I have magic. That means I'm smart. I may not know a lot, but let's go there. Maybe they can help me figure this out. So I think having a couple other options that will then lead them to the quest giver, and the quest giver in this case is at that center of higher learning, might have been helpful.
So I agree with everything that you're saying, and I would, you're absolutely right, and you would, and Josh would as well. We would flesh it out a little bit so it didn't seem so direct one or the other. In order for me to give the adventure credit for that, though, all it would need, and again, this is barely shade, this is a fantastic adventure, all it would need is one of those rule sidebars like they did for how to run the adventure, how to play the NPCs, they should have one, and it wouldn't take a lot, just how to expand the adventure within the ruins and talk to the storytellers about that for the ones that aren't as experienced, and say, hey, you don't want to just have two options for your players, and it shouldn't be as direct as this leads, but you can have any number of extra hallways or doors or rooms that you come up with to explore. And they could give a couple of examples or not. It wouldn't take a lot, just something in there to acknowledge that we only gave you these three plot point scenes. We welcome you to expand it and create more adventure for your players. That's all it needs.
A little collaborative world building or random encounter table would have been perfect in the city, in the ruins. Perfect. Yeah,
absolutely.
Just one more action beat, if you will, I think would work, because most games, and there are exceptions to this rule.
One more chapter in the park. Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't even have to be a chapter. It just has to be a subsection within the ruins. Just like one little adventure encounter. Doesn't have to be super difficult. It could be on the easy side. If we're talking CRs in D&D, we're talking low CR comparative to the party, whatever they are. If you're doing first level characters to do this, have it be CR zeros. You could have a pack of wolves roaming through, whatever. Some of these random bandits, something minor that's not related necessarily to the plot, but the victory condition or even the loss condition could yield some additional info that would be helpful.
Yep. So I'm going to go ahead and step back to the beginning a little bit here, because one other thing that I wanted to talk about that I thought that they did really well when they built this was that whole introduction section. We alluded to it earlier, but basically all the information that it's giving to the storyteller before the adventure begins, the instructions on how to go ahead and run the game, the adventure background. That adventure background is the kind of thing that you do not see all the time. I know recently I was listening to, I think it was probably Sean Merwin and Teo Sabadia's podcast, talking about the Planescape adventure book that came out a little while ago. And the one thing that they were talking about is that the one thing that adventure needed was a blurb for the storyteller at the beginning that said, hey, here's what's really going on, storyteller. Here's what you need to know, and here's what your players are going to learn during this adventure. But here are things that you need to know about this. And the problem is that without having that, when they actually happen in game, the storyteller's got a little flat-footed because, I guess that thing that we talked about three encounters ago was important, and I should have emphasized that, right? So that page and a half of content here, talking about the adventure background and all the things that are going to happen and all the things that the storyteller needs to know and everything like that, it was concise, it was interesting, it was well made, and it really set up the adventure. I think the one thing I would say about that is they should have put some sort of a spoiler warning on there so that if a player is reading through this and he's reading, oh crap, I just realized everything that's going on now. So I think that's maybe the one thing, maybe just a spoiler warning on that would have been nice so that players didn't accidentally stumble into the keys to the castle.
And we did decide when we started that we wanted to remain not spoiler free, but spoiler light. So we don't want to go into too much detail about what that background was. But I do also just want to say that the setting, and I'm going to give this piece as a little bit of a spoiler, is on the planet of Exlaris, which due to some calamity, which you can read about in the adventure, was thrown from its solar system and is now a rogue planet. And this so background cool. section talks about and summarizes how they figure out how to survive now that they don't have a sun and they're in perpetual darkness. And it was fantastic. And it really reminded me of the Shard of Zaros.
The Shard of Zaros, exactly. Yeah.
Which our listeners never really got to hear because we only ever recorded two sessions for it before the OGL kerfluffle put the nails in its coffin. But I still plan to revisit that. But that was the shard of a planet left after a catastrophe, and it had a false sun. And it really made me think of that setting a lot.
Yeah.
Yep. As I was reading that, I had made a bunch of notes. This is like the shard. It just really felt like I felt those vibes. And I really loved it. I loved the kind of the way that is, because we've been doing a lot of Star Trek, and which causes me to do a lot of real science and space race on YouTube. It's a great channel. No, they don't sponsor us. Hashtag call your boys TTJ. I love that kind of thing. I love documentaries on space and space travel, all of that. And I thought that background was so essential. And just like Josh said, I won't belabor it, but anybody who's been storytelling for a long time and has attempted to pick up pre-written modules has had that one where the player asks them a question while they're in chapter two, or makes a test or a check about so-and-so's motivations. And based on what they've read thus far and what appears on the stat block for that character, the GM answers truthfully because the player won the check. Come to find out at the end of the adventure, oh my God, they were the bad guy, and there's nothing in there at the end to give an explanation why you could have been so wrong when the player passed a check that should have divulged the information. And again, I'm not going to give the specifics because I want players to come at this when, if and when they play this game without knowing, but they actually give a good lead in to some of those checks. If so-and-so checks this, regardless of what they roll, they're going to sense X, Y, or Z. Those motivations might not be always whatever. I love that kind of instruction. I love that lead in because now as a GM, I can feel confident in how I role play the character. I don't have to worry about the random check. And oh my God, now I just busted canon. Now I got to figure some way to square this circle at the end. And I think that's just brilliant game design. It's excellent expository writing, certainly in the context of a tabletop game where you always have to be aware. Mysteries are tough in tabletop games because a die roll can create the revelation of truth. So if you don't write knowing that's a possibility, you run the risk of giving up the keys to the farm. Here at Tabletop Journeys, we've leveled up our game and we're prepared to make your next roll legendary. We've just started a partnership with FanRoll Dice and they have over 300 product options to choose from. Gemstone, metal, new liquid core dice, and so much more. Better yet, listeners to the Tabletop Journeys podcast can get 10% off on their orders when they follow the link below and use discount code PODCAST10. A portion of these purchases come back to us, and this is a great way for you to help support the show.
So, Liwanika, earlier you had mentioned the NPCs and how appreciative you were for the blurbs to go ahead and explain the NPCs. What did you think of the NPCs in general? Did you think that they were well-written? Were they written roundly? What did you think about them?
I really liked them, and I'm going to focus on the first two we come across in the city, the captain and the guard and the person running the tavern. But some of the other ones that you first come to in that first chapter, I love the description that is given to the characters. I love the care and attention to how these characters present, the use of their pronouns, the description as so-and-so is non-binary, but then they don't necessarily have a term for the other folks. They simply provide the he or her pronouns for the ones that present that way or that those are their given pronouns. I thought that was a masterstroke in how to really have that discussion without having that discussion and express those types of themes. So I really just love the way they constructed the discussion of these characters. But into the characters themselves, I love the interaction between the captain of the guard and the bartender. They gave us some stuff to play with. We talked about what if they want to explore the city some more? What if we do more? Heck, what if your characters, even after solving this adventure, choose to stay?
Which is an option in the adventure.
Which is an option, right? They gave us some meat. What's the backstory of these two characters? Why do they have whatever their feelings are together? These are great questions that every storyteller can do differently at their table, because while they don't give you 100% of all the details, there's just enough room to play it the way you want to play it at your table based on your table. If I'm running for 12-year-olds, I can structure that relationship and the reasons in one way. If I'm running for 30s and 40s and 50-something-year-olds, I can put a lot more narrative weight into that. I can put some real drama into there. What is the story between these two? Were they friends? Were they lovers? Were they whatever? Was there a bad deal? What's those types of things? You can take it so many different ways that I just love the way that came across.
And as we've been talking about the NPCs, just to really finish driving that point home, because you're not wrong, the relationships that they created and the connections that they made, they do give you like a little social hierarchy glimpse of the city that you could expand from. But I know we talked about the role-playing, how to role-play them sections, but I don't think we made the point that I just realized as I was scrolling back and forth looking at them, that first they give you a description of all of the NPCs and the background information. So
yep.
In the overview and background, you get to read about each NPC you're going to be playing with a physical description and a summary of their character and how they interact with the world and whatnot.
Yep.
But then they get their own special treatment in the text of the adventure,
yeah.
Each time they appear in a scene with role-playing Captain Trebin, instead of just learning about them, they're saying, in this scene, this is how they are. And that, it's fantastic.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the way that they organized that was really really useful. Give me all the information in the background that I'm going to need to understand these characters, maybe roll up some stats for them, something like that. And then when I'm reading through the actual plot, when I'm reading through the thing and that NPC comes up, give me two or three sentences about what that NPC is feeling right now. That's perfect. It makes it so easy. I absolutely love it.
Yep. And that. I will go so far as to say I made note of that because as we get ready to do more adventure writing in addition mm-hmm. to the supplement writing we have done thus far, we've done an adventure before. I think that's a brilliant technique that we could learn from. We I can have
if you go back and look at our Dragonlance adventure, you'll find that we did detail all of our NPCs that I think in the back in the allies and adversaries section, but we did also in every scene that involved dialogue and drama include a thing about how to play the people in it and things that they might say.
Well, like specifically Val, yeah.
Especially Val, but in that first scene with their parents in particular, there were samples yep. of what their mother might say or their father might say.
Yep.
But yeah, we were already going down this path, but yeah, it's nice to see it in something else and definitely reaffirms that it's a direction we should continue to go.
Yep. And that's what I meant. I'm like, without remembering those exact specifics that you brought up, Glenn, but knowing that, but they were absolutely there, I can say that it rang true for me when I was reading it and it gave me memories of what we had done. And so my thought is that is something that we can definitely double down on in the future. We can definitely make note of and make sure we're doing that as we do adventures. Beginning when we do our like really fine tune and give a really solid overview section, whether that's a one pager with that overview. And then the second page being here are all the NPCs you're going to meet and give all those descriptions up front. And then give us the role playing blurbs in the scenes when they appear and when it's necessary. And that way, everybody always, because motivations can change scene to scene. So you can do that as you go. And I think that's just brilliant design. And it's nice, like you said, nice to see it. So we can continue down that road because down that road lies really good things.
Yep.
Oh, and sorry for that chime. Let me mute that. And then, oh, fuck, not scan QR code. Damn you. Hang on. We'll have to cut all of this. Let me finish being an ass over here. Do not disturb is on. So why did that bang?
Marty, this part gets cut out.
All right. Fair enough. Right, and I find it entertaining. And also, I do that Marty's doing audio editing for us now. I didn't know that until I heard it during the episode. But
yeah. Marty, don't cut that out. That goes in the
blooper. That's a blooper, yeah.
All right. Let me hit this again. So I do also want to jump on something really quick that you mentioned, Lewinika, which was that the characters could choose to stay, because we haven't talked about that piece of it at all. So that probably didn't make a whole lot of sense to our listeners, but it plays directly into one of my absolute favorite things about this adventure, which is where the players actually come from.
Where the beginning. Exactly. I was going to say the same thing. You snaked me, you bastard.
Sorry. My bad, bro.
Sorry. Carry on.
Neener, neener, neener. So to finish snaking Josh, and I'm going to give you a little bit of a spoiler here, but the players come from Earth, and these folks have sent away for people to help them. I won't tell you why. And it summons people from Earth into their world, but they land in the bodies of the characters they created.
So cool.
Which I love. And I got to say, part of the reason for that is because it harkens all the way back to the beginnings of my forays into adult reading and adult fantasy fiction when I picked up a book called The Sleeping Dragon, Volume 1 of The Guardians of the Flame by Joel Rosenberg off of my father's bookshelf and sat down with it and started reading. Because in that book, Joel Rosenberg has the characters. All of the characters from the book are college students playing a game similar to Dungeons and Dragons, they don't call it that, around a table with one of their professors. And they've been doing this for a while, right? This is a campaign. They're higher level characters at this point, beyond first tier, end of second tier, entering third tier or so. But their storyteller is actually a wizard from another world who was defeated and had to flee. So he jumped planes and now he's teaching college as a professor. And he ports them all into their characters in the middle of this D&D session, and that's how their story starts out. So now here they are, modern people from Earth, and one of them's in the big bulky body of his fighter, Beric Cullinane. And the way that the author did it was so cool, because they can, if they relax into it, use all of the abilities of their characters, just like the people in this adventure. They have the muscle memory of how to cast spells or use a sword. But if they stop and think about it too much, they tend to let their modern mind get in the way and they jack it all up and everything goes to hell. Early on, that actually cost one of them their life because they're in the middle of picking somebody's pocket and they think like, how the hell am I doing this? And they flub it and all things go poorly. But at any rate, the moral of that story is it like harkened me all the way back to the beginnings of my fantasy days. And it was amazing. Now, the set of books, I've read the first five, by the way, just in case anybody chooses to look them up. I didn't know that there were more. I thought The Warrior Lives was where it ended, but apparently he put out five more before he died to a total of 10. They were good and I really enjoyed them, but they're older and they do have some things that I would call trigger warnings for the way that people used to think in them. Just to throw that out there in advance. But the meat and potatoes of trying to take yourself and put yourself into a D&D or whatever other role-playing game body and now be like, okay, shit, how would I react to being on this world now? That role-playing challenge being presented to all of the players, I absolutely adored.
One of the coolest LARP experiences I ever had was when friend of the show, James Hosier and Scott Boothby were running a LARP set in the modern day. It was multi-genre, so vampires and whatever, mages and humans and everything like that. But it was based on the TV show The Prisoner. And I was playing myself in the game. And all the introductions and everything were always like, Lee Winika playing so-and-so, blah, blah, blah. And so mine was always done as Josh Newton as himself, as a nod to like the TV reference, which I never picked up on until the very end. So it's like, oh, TV show. Got it. Okay. Yeah. Now this all makes sense. But it was one of the coolest role-playing experiences I think I've ever had. So yeah, I love that sort of thing. And it also plays into the trope of the fact that, look, any character that I play on some level is partly me, much like how any character Lee Winika plays is partly Lee Winika and any character you play is partly you and everything like that. And so it takes that, turns it up to 11. So
yeah. It really does. And it's the basis behind, I've mentioned it before, I listen to the Crit Show a lot, where I've been learning and mastering my Monster of the Week storytelling style under the tutelage of Rev, who runs that podcast. But part of what makes their party dynamic so dynamic is this is four friends, Rev's the storyteller, but the three players are playing themselves in a modern Monster of the Week world if they were monster hunters. So they have all of their memories and all of their camaraderie and all of their already created relationships to draw on while they're playing in the game. And it really makes for some great emotional moments because they have emotional stake in the characters and the people around them. And it's really cool.
I have had a great deal of experience with running games and or playing games where the player characters are the players fictionalized with the stats of whatever game system we're playing. Typically, I have done that with D&D games, but occasionally with Phase Rip. So one of my favorite all-time games, Phase Rip games, was not an actual Marvel setting. It was real world, a Groton, Connecticut, and the setup was based on an alien invasion, and it was designed after the aliens had actually taken over. I think almost similar to V, where they're in charge, life is going on. The alien headquarters was our high school, Fitch Senior High School, which is at the top of Fork Hill. So that makes sense for the aliens to be there. And one of their processing plants was the local grocery store, Stop and Shop, on Route 12, because we just love the setup of the building. One of the guys in the group actually worked there, so knew the whole inner layout, like what it looked like upstairs, and he was able to draw a map of it or whatever. And that's where people in Groton would have to go to get their rations for the week or whatever. So the idea of that was we played ourselves, and then we had superhero versions of ourselves based on a fifth column group that gave these special packs a la Ralph Hinkley that gave us unique powers or whatever. And I just remember how cool that was. And I've played a number of games. What if you build yourself as a character in D&D classless, like zero level, but make all your stats and find the skills that you actually know, and then now you got to go through and use some kind of training rules to see how you'd survive in the D&D world. Or D20 Modern, we built ourselves, and I did like a Voyagers or Sliders type spinoff kind of series. But it was myself, my friend Dave Garrett, his son Matthew, my son Robert, when they were like young teens. And we just did Sliders or Sliders / Voyagers in that way. And I just loved that concept, very similar to what I'm doing in Marty's game with my character Drake. Was if I was a little bit better at fighting and I was a janitor at a high fancy building and I stole a bunch of equipment so I could stick it to the man who was doing evil things, and I had my own little pseudo Iron Man Street Hawk kind of suit, what would I do? And that's the character I built. My starting stats were based on me. I didn't need it to be any bigger than that. I love anything that has that concept. I am all about. It's one of the things I'm looking forward to being able to do with Everyday Heroes is some riff on that as well. And honestly, I'm thinking of using that concept to get the characters in Everyday Heroes, and this adventure would be badass.
So just to put another spin on this, because we started out this piece talking about if the characters chose to stay. And one other small spoiler is at the very end of the adventure, it says that if any of the characters choose to stay, then on their world, when everybody else wakes up, the character they created wakes up on Earth.
Huh?
But what if instead, the whole time while these people are over and trying to solve the adventure on the rogue planet, what if the whole time they just body swapped and there were a bunch of people from this planet running around Earth? That would be more fun. You could make a whole nother like side session out of that.
Oh my God. Yeah. Could you imagine? Imagine how confused your players would be in the best way possible. If you said, okay, we're going to swap back and forth. We're going to play, we meet every other week. 1 week we're going to play one game, another game we're going to play another game, or even to go ahead and put it.
You're right where I was thinking.
Yeah,
yes,
totally. Yeah, exactly. And then all of a sudden it's like the grand climax is that they realize that they're actually the same celestial being just in two forms on two different planets. But even think about we were talking about the Shard of Zaros, right? Where, because again, like we were playtesting the 1D&D rules. So there are six players, 12 classes. Each of us had two characters. What if they were really the same character, or like two like mirror aspects of the same character or whatever? I think that there are so many cool things you can do with that. That is just, it's all just storyteller fuckery. It really is. Like, it is the best kind of storyteller effery. I'll censor myself on that one.
Yeah.
You know, and we're allowed one, right?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't claim it this time.
He got the first one.
Except when I typed my name in.
You're right, exactly.
Master.
Yeah.
Well, so. he got the first one, so he had to censor himself on the second one.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like I said earlier, one of the best things a printed module can do is give the storyteller room to create and inspiration with which to create beautifully. Yeah. And this adventure does that aplomb.
And it captures your imagination and just starts those gears spinning. It was really great. It was a great read.
It's really so good. So I am going to, I'm going to ask you guys a question and let you ruminate on it a little bit while I talk about something else. And when I ask the question, I think you'll understand why. And I think that this is really the question that we want to end tonight on. So this campaign was basically put out as a PR move for NASA, right? They wanted to go ahead and do something really cool. They gave the writer, Christina Mitchell, some latitude to go ahead and do something really cool, and absolutely freaking ran with it. Who next should do the same thing? Who should put out a role-playing game as a PR move for their widget, company, product, whatever? You think about that for a second. I'm going to go ahead and talk about one other point. So the other point that I want to go ahead and raise is for indie content creators out there, take heart. Here is a product that was put out by NASA. Now, granted, it's a free product, right? But it's put out by NASA, huge PR effort and everything like that. If you read the credit page at the very end, all of the art in the book is stock art. So for those of you that are putting together indie content creation books, do not despair that if you have to resort to stock art, if you don't have the budget to go ahead and hire full artists, it's a perfectly acceptable way to get your book to print, to get your book out on the internet, to get other people playing your stuff. Don't feel bad about using stock art. That's all that I wanted to say. I just wanted to get on that little soapbox for a second and give my two illustrious co-hosts the chance to go ahead and ruminate on the question and to go ahead and revisit it. Who next should take the tabletop role-playing game route as a PR move for their product, company, whatever? Go ahead, Glenn. I see you with your hand up.
I wanted to jump out there to make sure I wasn't snaked, so I got my hand up first because I think that kind of going with the outer unexplored area that we've got going on right now, which is what they did with this, was fantastic. Let's take it to what we've already got going on our planet currently that's so unexplored and so unknown and say, how about an oceanology company?
Like NOAA? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. NOAA so would we're be looking great. At, you got all kinds of things you can bring in there if you go from the D&D side, from Titan Stabiliths to Sea Folk, and maybe they're really deep. You got all kinds of ways that you could get them down there, whether or not you're working with full-on modern science, steampunk science, or magical water breathing and free movement spells, etc. like that.
Yep.
I think that taking something like this where you're blending our modern world to draw attention to your field of science or your thing and include real pieces like they did with gravity lensing, etc., that could be super cool. A full-on underwater, undersea adventure based on oceanography and marine biology and stuff, that could be hot.
Yep, totally agree with you. All right, Mr. Miller, what do you got?
I'm going to take the baton from Glenn, and I'm going to ramp this up a big notch. I think PBS's Aeons, which is a YouTube channel to which I am subscribed to,
now that's
absolutely
a hot take.
Knocks this out of the frickin' park. And I say that knowing that if they chose to do this, they're going to put some of the work I've done previously and have in plans in the future to shame, because much of the research that has gone into some of the fauna that I have planned for future projects is based on research from their YouTube videos and website pages and things like that. If you recall, several years ago when I did a bunch of dinosaurs and early Pleistocene era critters, the primary resource then verified with other sources was PBS Aeons and their videos that can range anywhere from 10 to 30 minutes, depending on the topic. They have given me so much creature and monster character creation ideas for the games that we have already written and that we continue to write, that they take something like this concept and crush it. Yep. And they even already have the personalities that if they did an actual play, some of the folks that they have, a couple of the folks that are their spokespeople that are on their YouTube videos, them sitting down at a table in a Critical Role style doing a game like this, didn't hit. No question. I'm here for it all day. If they and if they're looking for some writers who can put the pieces together, they fill in the science, they double check the what we do. I'm just saying, I might know a team that could make that happen for them.
Hashtag.
Yep, and we do have a budget for art, right? I'm saying, you want a partner?
Let us know. So I'm going to go picking just one for me is difficult. I will be totally honest. I am channeling my inner Lee Wanico where I asked myself for one, but I'm going to give myself multiple because I made the rules. The first one that I came up with at first was the British Museum, but not the British Museum because they're not great people, but like a museum that specializes in antiquity and stuff like that, I think that there's definitely some room in there for an RPG of some variety. I think that there's a bunch of different plot lines that they could go with. They could play with time travel. They could play with all these different things. Mm-hmm. So that was one direction that I went. And then another direction that I went was like thinking about like the CIA or the FBI, like going with like the play on the James Bond RPG from the early 80s there.
That could be cool.
In Her Majesty's Secret Service, I think was the name of it or something Yeah. But like that kind of thing, like a CIA-based role-playing game, I think would be hot. And then the more I started thinking about it, and I'm not sure that you guys even know the story, so if you don't, bear with me here, but there is a book called Chasing Vermeer that is about a theft of seven Vermeer paintings from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. And you can still go to the museum and they still have the empty frames where these paintings were stolen from. I think that if their PR group, again, you want to talk about a group of people that I'm like, if you want us to go ahead and write an adventure about what happened to these paintings,
right?
We are all over that. Or recovering them, like exactly. Mm-hmm. Make it all like X-Files, like Supernatural. There are so many things that I could go ahead and do with this. Did the paintings come alive and become people and walk out of the building? Who knows what happened to these paintings? But I would love to do this for you. If the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum gets an email from us with this episode saying how much we would love to go ahead and do this, you know how to go ahead and reach us. You'll have our email address.
And I mean, you mentioned historical settings and anything from the Museum of Natural History to the Smithsonian could do the same thing.
Oh my goodness.
And that just reminded me also, there's even vehicles out there already for any storytellers that listen to this and are inspired. You don't have to wait for them to come up with one. There's nothing wrong with creating a game set in our world, set in history, set at any, I'm even possibly working with a gentleman on a game called, to rephrase that. There are even, as an example, one of the vehicles out there for it would be a game called Shadows of the Past, which is 100% focused on telling stories within our history and the past and of our world in different time periods and in different locations. It's by a guy named George Fleming, and it could be used for it. There are a number of other modern games that you could use to come up with the spy games, etc. You don't have to wait for them. You could set these things up yourself.
Yeah. Yep.
So if you want to play somebody who rode beside William Wallace in the war for Scotland's independence, you can pick a system and roll up any of your favorite historical periods and write a story.
Yep. So anyway, all fabulous suggestions. And if any of these come to print, you may see it with the TCG logo on it in the near future here. Anyway, that is our show for tonight. Let's see. So next week we are actually, so the folks over at Darrington Press have just today released some playtest material for Daggerheart. We are anxiously pouring through that. We're going to talk about it next week on the show here. So we're going to get into the character generation and the pre-generated characters that are in there. And then coming up here in a couple of weeks, we're going to be bringing back old friend of the show, Jay Moores, and he's going to be running another game of his game Fae for us. It's received some updates. It's received some changes. We're really anxious to go ahead and revisit our characters from a couple of years ago. You can be Puddin', absolutely. Yep,
well, my understanding is we're going to be playing the new supplement, so we're going to be playing the other side of the equation. I'm not 100% on better. That. So, right. Like the latest version that came out, it's not even a version. It's not so much a change in the game. It's the next supplement.
Nice.
First game was the Fae end of things. The next game is the human-esque ones that know about the monsters or whatever.
Ooh,
so, nice. Remember, so this is going to be, I believe that's what we're going to do. I don't know that. I'm going to be confirming that, but either way, it's Jay, it's game, the game, it's those mechanics, it's that beautiful art that Jay has put together for us, and I'm here for it.
Yep. Didn't put it together for us. He put it together for himself. But
yeah, but we've played it before and had a fantastic time with Faye already once. If you're interested, you can actually go back into our back catalog and check that one out.
Search for FAE.
FAE Faye.
FAE is the name of the game. Check out the original actual play. Ton of fun. And I'm really excited to have Jay back on the show. Yeah. All right, everybody. Thank you very much for listening. Appreciate you taking the time. As always, love to go ahead and hear your thoughts on what you thought about the NASA adventure, Lost Universe. We think it's going to be just a ton of fun. And I bet you that I can see one of us trying to make a go of it at some point here in the near future. We'll see what happens here. But we'd love to hear your comments. We'd love to hear your thoughts. As always, please make sure you reach out to us on social media or catch us comment on the episode if you listen to us on the website. So love to go ahead and hear from you. Anyway, that's our show for the evening. We'll be back next week talking about Daggerheart. Thank you all for listening. And yeah, we'll talk to you then. Have a good night, everybody.
Later. Good night, all.
Thank you for joining us. This has been Tabletop Journeys. We would love to hear your feedback on our show today. Join us at www.ttjourneys.com, where you can subscribe to the blog to leave comments and see all the content that we publish beyond the podcast.
You can also stay in touch by subscribing to our Twitter, Tumblr, or Instagram at ttjourneys, joining our Facebook group, Tabletop Journeys, or by sending an email directly to podcast@ttjourneys.com. Our full episodes come out every week on Friday, and every Tuesday features actual play and gameplay showcase episodes. Looking for early access? You can support the show and get episodes before everyone else at www.patreon.com/ttjourneys. Check it out today and see all the awesome benefits we bring to our supporters.
Lastly, if you're listening to us on Stitcher, iTunes, Podchaser, Spotify, or Audible, we would really appreciate it if you would like and subscribe to the podcast on that platform. Thank you for listening and for being a part of our growing community. And we bid you fair tides, friends, for legends await.